I'm very pleased that we had a coffee break after the Senator's chairmanship of the previous session. It's a very hard act to follow. I just want to say one or two things, if I may, in relation to my own role here, in case there's any subsequent confusion. I was invited by Frank Kilgan to chair this session, and on the basis that it would involve a discussion on the rail directive, and I was very glad to do so. But I subsequently learned that some people were promoting the conference on the basis that it was a conference against the proposed EU constitution, and I just want to make it clear that my own union hasn't taken a position on that proposition as of yet. We did embark on the initial stages of a consultation process in the organisation in relation to it, and we had a presentation at our executive by Prontius de Rossa, and we had Councillor De Borca, from presenting the alternative view, and it was our intention that we would embark on some kind of a structured consultation process. I have to say that I was very glad to find myself in being in the position of being able to say, as Roger said earlier, that hopefully it's now indefinitely buried. And we won't have to face that particular hurdle again. But in any event, I'd like to introduce Brian Denny. Brian is a journalist. He worked for a long time as a journalist, lifelong trade unionist, and now an officer with the RNT. And he's been very active in the campaign against neoliberalism in the British trade union movement, and in the campaign against the Services Directive and other nefarious propositions. And I think Brian is going to speak on the Services Directive and the Rail Directive and some other related aspects. So Brian, I'd like to welcome you here, and I'm sure everybody will be glad to hear you. So Brian Denny.
Yeah, I've been greeting some of the trade unions against the EU constitution, which a campaign has been running since it was developed, and also from the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, the RMT. We are actually having our AGM in Dublin this year for the first time, so the General Secretary, Bob Crowe, said I was like a scouting party looking for friends. And he said we need friends because the conference takes place in the first week of July, which is when the semi-finals of the World Cup are on. So we need as many friends as we can get. Yeah, we're hoping so. The last time I was here was in May 28th last year, a conference on the EU Constitution. And the next day it was voted down. And now we are speaking a couple of days after the passing of the Services Directive, the Bolkestein Directive, or even the Macready Directive, however way you want to take it, because Charles Macready has obviously now taken over from the work that Fritz Bolkestein started. Under the French, after the French and Dutch rejection of the EU constitution, we put a call out, as it did many democratic movements, that the process was now dead, that the constitution was now dead. But I think Roger Cole made clear that he's in a state of being undead, and the Commission certainly does not like to accept no as an answer lightly. I mean, as the Irish know, you had to vote twice on the same treaty on Nice. But it's a bit more difficult for them now because the constitution is in much more of a state of hiatus than the Nice Treaty was. Therefore, there is a plan B, and that is to implement the constitution by parts, effectively illegally. And this is what's happening. Roger Cole made that clear earlier on in the earlier session, that battle groups are developing And that can only be done under the terms of the Constitution. And they are adopting those parts of it. A diplomatic service is being set up, even though the Constitution hasn't been passed. And also the Services Directive is a part of that process. Speaking before the Constitution was voted on in France, Tony Blair said in the British Parliament that the Services Directive was part and parcel of the EU Constitution, to liberalise services across the EU. And before I get into the where we are now in terms of the country of origin principle and all the rest of it, I think we should look at the genesis of the Services Directive and where it comes from. It goes right back to the beginnings of the setting up of the European Union, or the Common Market, it was called. And the Treaty of Rome specifically says, calls for the free movement of services, goods and labour. So the free movement of services is in the initial treaty. And then it's also that there was a state of hiatus because there wasn't much enthusiasm to liberalise services across the Europe back in the day, back in the 1970s and 80s, of course. And so the Single European Act was developed, and that was signed 20 years ago this week. And it's no accident, I don't think, that we're having a vote on the Services Directive 20 years after the Single European Act was brought into existence to kickstart the development of the internal market, the Single European Market. There was no enthusiasm for this development, and so a group was set up called the European Roundtable of Industrialists, the ERT, to promote the free movement of goods, services and labour, regardless of the consequences. Now, when people start talking about industrial groups of industrialists, people think conspiracy theories start developing and 10-foot green lizards and all the rest of it. But if you do a simple search on Google, the ERT are quite open about the work they do. They are a lobbying group that operates on behalf of corporate sector, big business. That's what they were set up to do. And they openly say they are have very good relations with all leaders of the member states' governments within within the EU. In fact, the Wise-Decker of Philips, which is one of the companies that is in this group, the ERT, it's got about 50 companies are members of it. But the membership is only by invitation only. It's a very cosy little relationship. You don't apply to join. You are asked to join this group, the European Roundtable of Industrialists. And Wise-Decker came up with the idea of relaunching Europe and drawing up a document called Europe 1990. This is way back in the early 1980s. And he said, when he launched it, he openly said, "If we wait for our governments to do anything, we'll be waiting for a long time. We cannot get tied up with politics. Industry has to take the initiative." And that meant drawing up a document which Jacques Delors, the European Commission President at that time, said the ERT was one of the main driving forces behind the single market. So this document was written up. And it's quite interesting the way it was written up. Wise-Decker, this Philips official, drew together four Philips experts on economics. And he told them, "Imagine yourselves to be the dictators of Europe, and you have decided that the job must be done within 5 years. At first, they didn't like the idea, but once they picked it up, they found it fascinating, and they discovered that it could be done given the political will." In other words, the policy of the ERT, of 50 main corporations in Europe, was then adopted and developed in the Single European Act, which promoted the single market. So it's a very, very long-term project, the free movement of services and labour. And there's no accident that it's coming at the same time. In fact, Ireland, Britain and Sweden are the three countries that have opened up the labour markets, which I'll come to later. Now, in the imaginations of the European Parliament over this vote, a lot of play was made about the country of origin principle, the highest kite that was flown of all, of actually allowing low-wage member states to impose their conditions unilaterally on other member states. And quite rightly, there was a massive campaign of ships who very effectively took part in about the country of origin principle. And so that was removed. But we have to remember that the Services Directive was passed, which allows the deregulation and the opening up the free market of all within public sectors. And some sectors were exempted. But the day after the vote, on Thursday, I think, it was in the Financial Times, Charlie McCreevy said, "Those sectors that were exempted will be dealt with separately." Transport was exempted from the Services Directive, which was a great victory, apparently. Well, the first Rail Directive was brought in 1991, Directive 91/440, which demanded the privatisation of rail networks across Europe. And it was put in very secretly, no one knew about it at the time. And when the British government privatised the railway so disastrously as they did, no one actually knew it was on the direct basis of the 91/440 directive. In fact, the Act of Parliament that privatised the railways was actually an addition to the European Communities Act of 1972. So it was directly to adopt the directive as a whole. The directive demanded a liberalisation model that was unprecedented, never been tried before, but it was imposed upon us. A vertical split separating rail infrastructure from operations. The directive directly demands the operational autonomy for rail operators, the separation of infrastructure from services, and the open access of international undertakings and the introduction of track charges. That process was the British Rail privatisation model. And I don't have to tell you that has led to the deaths of dozens of passengers and even more track workers that have died as a result of a single infrastructure entity being smashed into 500 or 600 different pieces of contractors and subcontractors, and where track workers were killed purely because other track workers didn't know they were there, and vehicles were sent down and people have died by the dozen. And that's just what's happened to the workers on the railway. But now I have to tell you about Hatfield and a whole list of disasters that have taken place purely because subcontractors were more concerned about making money than providing a public service to passengers. Now this process is happening all over Europe. Now that even the French have split their infrastructure. I know the Irish have. Irish Rail has split their infrastructure, still in the public hands, but they're waiting for a moment to demand that this is liberalised. In other words, that the state removes itself from the industry. And only last month there was the deadline that all rail freight must be liberalised across the EU. Now it hasn't happened purely because the member states are refusing to implement the directive that's so dangerous. The French and the Germans in particular are saying, well, we don't want it because we've seen what happened in Britain and we don't want that to happen in our railways. And there isn't the political will anymore to impose that disastrous directive onto the German rail industry, which is quite interesting when you consider the Commission supposed to speak and we're all supposed to jump. Well, the French and Germans certainly aren't. And I think that's an inkling of the development of conflict that's going to develop across the EU as the unelected Commission tries to impose itself unilaterally onto member states. And the postal services is another sector. Britain is a long way in front of all this because we are very gung-ho with liberalisation, as you're aware. But the idea of a postal service is a very democratic one. Everyone can put a letter, and they all cost the same, it all gets to the same place. Well, if you bring in subcontractors and liberalise the whole thing, they cherry pick the freight and the large boxes, all the little letters, well, they can go hang and they can develop on themselves without state involvement. Therefore, governments, elected governments, are slowly being removed from various industries. Now, the other thing about the country of origin principle coming out of the vote this week is that the Federalists are saying that the country of origin principle is still implicit within the Services Directive as it is, because, and see, the thin end of the wedge to keep developing this idea of a single market where national boundaries are slowly removed and opened up to the free market of the one, as if it was one state. In other words, you can't have a barrier, it must be all the same. So the country of origin principle would actually exist, even if it doesn't in name. The other problem that exists is the continuing transfer of power to the European Court of Justice. And there's a perfect example that's going ahead at the moment called the Vaxholm case, where the Swedish Building Workers Union discovers that in Vaxholm, a Latvian company had set itself up using Latvian labour. And so the Swedish Building Workers Union demanded a collective agreement which covers those workers in order to stop social dumping developing, where they get paid literally a third of their wages next to them. And they said that was not acceptable in any way, shape or form. And so they began industrial action. But the company, Laval, said they had a perfect right to do what they were doing under the articles of the existing treaty. And obviously there was an argument that developed, and it was taken to the Swedish Labour Courts, and the Swedish Labour Court decided that they had to give the decision, not with them, but to the European Court of Justice. They've delayed that case specifically because of the Services Directive vote, and the amount of press and publicity that was put on that case has been delayed until after this vote. There'll probably be a ruling in April, probably at the end of April, in which they will decide if the industrial action in support of demands for a collective agreement is in compliance with EU law, notably Article 49 on the freedom of movement of to provide services. Now, while all this was going on, Charles McCreevy, the internal market minister, made a visit to Stockholm. And he said he fully backed the Latvian company because it was within their rights to impose social dumping in such a way because the rules allowed it. And he actually made a statement to the press, and he said, "If member states continue to shield themselves from foreign company takeovers and competition, then I fear that the internal market will begin to dissolve. The question here is whether or not Sweden has implemented Article 49 in the Treaty on Free Movement." So, as far as he's concerned, any East European or offshore firm can impose their will on Sweden with or without the country of origin principle or even the services directive. Understandably, this has caused consternation within the Swedish TUC, the LO, which, by the way, backed Euro membership in 2002 and the constitution before that, after that. That particular referendum was lost, and they've said that if this case goes the way it does, they will be campaigning to withdraw from the European Union, which is a massive sea change in attitudes to, because as a matter of their understanding of what power the European Court of Justice can have on them. And the Vice President Lundby Wenden points out that industrial action actually, by its very nature, is an obstacle to a company for free movement. By its very nature, it stops free movement. So, but the collective action, the right to collective action, is enshrined in international law. And so she takes it very seriously, and she even said that what until now has been regarded as a fundamental right of workers in all democratic states would be undermined in the name of free movement. So we can see what the single market is. The single market is, and what the Services Directive is. The single market is a mechanism to remove powers from nation states to control capital, people, in the pursuit for the corporate sector for profit. It's as simple as that. And at the same time, it truncates national democracy, including the right to wages, working conditions, social protection, and to collective bargaining. And all this, obviously, has massive implications for organised labour across the EU. Now, it brings us to the sticky issue of the free movement of labour, which I think we have to deal with at the same time, because there's no accident the Service Directive was brought in as member states are being asked to open up their labour markets completely to foreign labour. There's a problem with this. It's happened, I know it's been since 2004. Already they're experiencing this brain drain from Eastern Europe. In Latvia alone, I think there's about 100,000 workers have left that country to work in the West. In a country of less than 2 million, it's had a devastating effect in terms of how they develop. Poland is even more the case, where they must be drawn to the West to work for higher wages. So what we're seeing is a process of labour moving to the West and capital moving to the East. And that will mean a leveling out of wages much lower, under their terms, than we have at the moment. It doesn't end there. I mean, the EU Commission President Barroso has said that we must lure talent from the south, in other words, Africa, to capitalise on the lucrative international education market by offering top students, in other words, A-grade students, will get automatic EU membership. But if you're a bit below that, you don't get it. Now, there's a leading South African MP, Kade Asmal, has absolutely gone ballistic about this because he sees it as absolute economic colonialism and imperialism raising itself at a stroke. And the way he said EU countries assist in the developing higher education in the south and then wish to take the cream of PhD students by seducing them with the offer of citizenship. This is not a brain drain, this is the destruction of intellectual capital of the south. In other words, labour is being drawn in from the low skill sector and from the high skill sector to increase corporate profit. Whose benefit, I think we can start to understand whose benefit it is. And the sweated labour certainly do not benefit from such a situation. So as a result, foreign labour is using as a battering ram to push down national standards and increase the development of social dumping. And it's a very serious situation we're in because it doesn't only affect the construction industry or any other, the Irish ferries for instance, or the ferry industry. It affects every industry. And it destabilises countries, and it puts an ever-growing burden on the social welfare of those countries. But also, it removes the right of member states to bring in legislation that protects these migrant workers from such exploitation. And on top of that, we've got the anti-trade union laws in Britain, which did not allow us to take secondary action to defend vulnerable workers. For instance, the Gate Gourmet dispute at Heathrow is a perfect example where mainly British Asian women were pushed out of their jobs by the employers and replaced with East European labour at a massively lower rate. So it's a process that's already developing, and it's a very serious situation, but there is the people. The people do not like what they see. And we are seeing in Britain a massive increase in understanding within the labour movement of what this means, not just for organised labour, but for the whole workforce. And there's an increase in understanding that something needs to be done. Now, across Europe, people are feeling the pressure of downward pressure on wages. And so it's up to people like ourselves to develop a political understanding so that this can be shown and people can act upon it. And it does work. I mean, in Estonia, they are renationalising their railways against all EU directives. And they're taking them back on hold. That's the infrastructure and the rail network. So it can be done. I mean, in terms of what the commission is, it really is a paper tiger. It thinks it can do these things. But if you can get our elected governments to resist and say we are not doing it, just as the French and the Germans are doing, then that is expose the fact that they have no mandate whatsoever to do what they are doing. The European Commission is unelected, but it is the legislative. The European Parliament can only say yes or no to legislation written by the Commission. And the European Court of Justice is decides what is legally right, but it doesn't represent anyone. I want to finish on a quote that was someone said in 1973, before Britain and Ireland joined the EU, in fact, and he was a commission president, a Dr. Sicco Mansholtz. And he described how the EU works within the structures in Brussels. And he said, the commission proposes, the European Parliament gives opinions, and the Council of Ministers decides. And without more ado, the individual citizen is committed. The ordinary decision-making processes, as we know it in the individual state, does not exist in the community. And he said that all those years ago, before Britain was even a member, when Ireland was even a member of the EU. And I don't think that the Irish electorate or the British electorate would have signed up and voted for that if they'd have known that that was the attitude that existed in the within the Euro-Federalist heart. And so it's up to us, and it's up to the member states to put forward progressive arguments of why there should be national control of laws on immigration and on legal rights for the people that work here, and not down to the corporate sector to decide. If we don't, the ultra-right will, and the far-right will grow on this. And as the ultra-right developed this idea of national independence instead of the left, I think the European Commission will quite like that, because then they could say, well, we must remove these civil liberties and continue to turn the screw on popular movements, because we can't have all this fascist activity. And of course, people will suffer on the streets, as we know. So it's down to the left to emerge as, to speak for the people and speak in the name of sovereign states. We are the people. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. And as I understand it now, we have a number of contributors from the floor before we start open the general debate.
I'm not sure as to the reason why it was decided that the other contributors would contribute from the floor. I hope it's nothing to do with the fact that I'm chairing the meeting. Brendan Young, you're first to, on the list here.
I'm just going to give a brief outline of what I think the outcome of the services directive was. Okay, that's a good idea. Well, it goes without saying. There are confusing interpretations of the outcome. Rory Quinn said on the radio and spoke to Susan George last night that it was a defeat for the support of neoliberalism and a setback. I think actually it's probably not the case. You have both the Party of European Socialists and the PPD, that's the Euro Tories, saying that it's a victory for Ireland, while it can't be a victory for both. If you look at the aim of the directive, which is to liberalise trade and services, including public services, that means competition between private providers and public services, the upshot of which is privatisation. That's a clear objective of the directive. If you look at the original draft by the Commission, it's very clear that they want to trade in all services. There have been some setbacks in that. But private provision means services you can pay, and a section of the money that goes into the service, that pays for the service, goes to the shareholders' pockets. That's the upshot of privatisation. It means slamming quality service and loss of democratic control. And explicit in the presentation by the Commission at the FORFOS discussion last year was an admission that the Services Directive and the creation of a unified market and service in the EU was about the gaps. It was about the EU being able to, with Mandelson or Pierre Lamy Reform, being able to negotiate in the gaps for the whole European services market. So there's a direct link there. But both sides can't have won. The two key issues that were discussed, in broadly speaking, the anti-globalisation or ultra-globalisation movement, were the country of origin principle, the exclusion of public services from the global directive.
There is some confusion over the question of the country of origin principle. In the press release from the European People's Party, the EPP, they say that the country of origin, and Brian has clearly referred to that, country of origin is already in EU law and is clearly in European Courts of Justice case law. The case law of the ECJ has defended service providers or providers in general working on the basis of their own country laws. So the actual amended proposal that went to the vote, which took out the words country of origin principle, the amended proposal came from the EPP, it came from the Euro Tories, and the proposal is the rubric is a freedom to provide services. A state is required to allow a service provider to provide a service on their territory. And there, I won't go into the detail, there are three major areas, but very narrow areas in which that can be restricted. But the member states are required to allow a service provider to provide a service. You can't block them. There is in the text the provision for each member state to implement its own laws, but there is no a priori requirement on the provider to observe the laws of the state in which they're providing the service. In other words, there is no country of destination principle. Pat Rabbit, I think I heard him say on the radio the other day that there is a country of destination. If you look at the text, there is no country of destination principle. In other words, a service provider is not legally bound in the text to observe the laws in the country in which they provide the service. It's up to the state there to actually chase them. Now, if you think of health and safety provision here and the number of health and safety inspectors going on building sites or catering establishments or social care homes, that's the sort of situation you get into with the catch me if you can type of situation. And Susan alluded to it this morning, the questions of registration and tracing non-nationally based companies is very difficult. So essentially, although the words country of origin principle have been removed, it's there in the European Court of Justice case law, it's there in Article 49, and this new clause will not block the country of origin rules applying. The final arbiter in all of this will be the European Court of Justice. So in my view, the Euro Tories are correct. They have actually got a situation where, in effect, country of origin will apply, and it will be difficult to block. The second big area of public discussion is what services are excluded from the provisions of the directive. What this means is what services a state can say cannot be set up because they would be in competition with the public service, or they would be in competition with public policy. Now, there is the exclusion of some services, employment agencies, some transport services, audiovisual services are excluded, and healthcare services, but there's confusion on this between public and private healthcare. In other words, if there's already private healthcare, a state cannot restrict competition from another provider. If there's any existing competition or any existing payment for services, then you cannot restrict another transnational provider coming in and providing. So the healthcare one, there's an ambiguity, and I think it opens the door there. What's explicitly excluded, what's explicitly not excluded, amendments that would have excluded certain services that were voted down are education services, culture services, environmental services, distribution and purification of water, waste, funeral services, postal services, energy services, and services for the storage of dangerous goods. Now, these services been excluded from the list of derogations. In other words, services that do not come under, this is in the list of services that do not come under the remit of the directive, these have been excluded. So they're included in the scope of the directive. And these are major public services. Think about it, water, wastewater disposal, education services. Once again, there's some ambiguity in this, but it was voted down that education services be excluded, and we can give you the list of amendments and the votes on them. So, in my view, this is not a game for those who are those who support the project of a social Europe. This is a game for the neoliberals and the Commission. There have been some restrictions to their game, but on the whole, they have gained, and it cannot be, I think, spun otherwise. I think what we have to, where we should go from here, is to call for the government, the Irish government, to vote against this directive in whatever form it arrives, because Charlie McCreevy will redraft it more towards the original position of the Commission, which was a very liberalising position. The redrafting will lean that way. He's an old dog and he's not going to change. So I think we need to call for an Irish vote against this directive when it goes to the Council of Ministers. That's the next step. It then goes back, that's the redrafted one from the Commission. The Commission sends it to the Council of Ministers and they vote on it. We want an Irish vote against that. The second thing is that when it subsequently goes to the European Parliament for a second reading, we want all Irish parties, including the PES, to vote against it. Now, this redraft will not change substantially what has already been voted on. And the third thing is that I think that trade unions, NGOs and all those involved in the partnership discussions should make opposition to this this directive a condition of acceptance of any deal. And this directive is at the throat of the gains of the post-war movement. It's neoliberalism driving into it. That's why there was so much controversy about it. It's probably the most controversial directive in 5 years in the European Parliament. It's open in its objectives. So I think that it's important to actually call the government to order on it and refuse to go into any deal that does not have government opposition to this. Thanks.